In late December 1980, there was a series of reported sightings of unexplained lights near Rendlesham Forest, Suffolk, England, which have become linked with claims of UFO landings. The events occurred just outside RAF Base Woodbridge, which was used at the time by the United States Air Force. USAF personnel, including Deputy Base Commander Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, claimed to see things they described as a UFO sighting. The occurrence is the most famous of claimed UFO events to have happened in the United Kingdom, ranking among the best-known reported UFO events worldwide. It's been compared to the Roswell UFO incident in the United States and is sometimes referred to as Britain's Roswell. When we come back, I'll speak with Gary Heseltine, the retired British police detective and editor of UFO Truth magazine, about his explosive and controversial new documentary about Rendlesham called Capel Green. Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Gary Heseltine, editor of UFO Truth magazine. And you wear a lot of hats. Among them is screenwriter. How did Capel Green come about?
Completely out of the blue. I got a phone call from what turned out to be the director, Dion Johnson, who basically told me that he'd had a chance meeting with Larry Warren whilst he was walking with his daughter around the UFO trail in the forest at Rendlesham Forest, which is pretty amazing because Larry Warren lives 200 miles away from Rendlesham Forest, and the odds of them meeting up were very, very slim. He didn't know him beforehand, but did was vaguely aware of the story, recognised him, approached him, and basically said, I'm a documentary filmmaker, I just want to say hello. And then he suddenly said, can I film you, do a little interview with you? He always carries a little camera with him, a video camera. And then he basically said, I'd like to make a documentary with you. And I think Larry was taken aback a bit. And as a result of that, he said, well, maybe you should contact Gary Heseltine. So that's how he rang me. Now, I'm thinking that this guy, who had never met before, never heard of, was seeking finance to make the documentary, like TV. That's how they usually start. And he explained to me what was on, and I said, well, you are aware that there's a pretty strong media campaign trying to discredit him at the moment, and he said, I know some of it. And I said, well, if I was trying to get funding, I would seek to have a polygraph test done first, and if he passes that, then I think you'll get your finance to make your what I thought was a TV program. And so anyway, I didn't know any polygraph examiners because it's not used per se by the British police, although I think there is some talk of it coming in time, but it's not used widely in the UK other than in private practice. And basically he went away, rang me 2 weeks later and said, I've got somebody who's going to do a polygraph. Do you want to get involved in that process? And I said, oh, of course. Now, it turns out that the person they got is a lady called Patty Musicaro, who's an American, Anglophile, living in London. And basically, she is Britain's most experienced polygraph examiner. I think she's the secretary or chairwoman of the British Association of Polygraph Examiners. And she's done over 2,000 tests. She's worked with the US police, the British police. She's worked in private practice. And so she's very eminently qualified. And she was doing it for free because it was something different. And I said, OK, great. I'll come down. I'd never been near a polygraph examiner, never talked to one. And basically, as you well know, when you do film shoots, it can take for hours to get the camera set up. And the idea was that Larry Warren was going to be filmed on remote cameras during the actual test. I think five remote cameras. So that took a lot of setup. So we had a lot of time, well, just to chat, and obviously did chat to her and whatever and the film crew. And eventually got to the stage where she said, right, everybody's got to leave the house and while we do the test. So we all went outside. Some of us went to a cafe, and about 30 minutes later, we get a phone call, you can come back. And the long and short of it was he passed with flying colours, and that will be revealed in the film. So that then gave you the premise that his incident in the field had occurred. And so it then turned out that Dion was independent. He wanted to make an independent film. And he said, would you be the lead researcher and co-writer? And I said, yes. And actually, I was very excited by the opportunity to do so because I've worked on many TV documentaries. And if TVs or TV companies putting up the money for the documentary, they always have their own bias of how the final show will look. And it generally takes the form of good information, pro-ET stuff in the first 20 minutes. Then it will go into a middle segment of just general history of UFOs. And then the final bit is the skeptics come on there and the public at the end are no wiser than when they started. Well, by being independent and with this being such a fantastic case, it gives me the opportunity to present more information to the public than ever has been shown in a TV documentary to date. And I will do that. That is my pledge to your audience, to anyone who's listening, that there will be more facts revealed about the history of Rendlesham, new facts, old facts. We've discovered a lot of new things during the course of this 18 months so far. The film's due to release in probably summer, probably May, June time this year. We've over 50 interviews. It's a massive project that began very small and then just kind of like snowballed. And because of its size now, that's what's causing the delay. But it will reveal, and this is my pledge on air to anyone, that it's going to reveal more facts. And if you think about why I am doing this, is I had a 7-year collaboration period with Colonel Holt, which ended in about 2014-2015. I'd written one film screenplay about Rendlesham that got quite close to being made at one time, but basically I withdrew it, cutting a long story short. The opportunity to have no TV bias, no TV UFO bias, for me is very exciting. And as I say, there is I think what I should say first is that you said in your introduction that it's controversial. Well, it's only controversial, really, in the last 2.5 years, because there's been a very big concerted campaign to discredit his original account.
Well, I got to ask you about that, Gary, because yeah. Most people remotely familiar with Rendlesham, they know about Colonel Holt, they know about John Burroughs, they know about Jim Peniston, but they don't know about Larry Warren. Who is he?
The original military whistleblower. Military whistleblower. And he was the person who talked to Larry Fawcett in later 82. He met with Bob and Betty Luker, Betty Andreasen. You remember the Andreasen abduction affair?
Yes.
He met with them. They said, well, we know a Connecticut police officer called Larry Fawcett. They met up. Larry was the first person to say, I was there, this happened. And from that led to the Freedom of Information Act cause request that unexpectedly, and this is the key thing to say, Larry Warren did not know the Holt memo existed. Nobody in the world, apart from Holt and Colonel Williams Conrad, the base commanders, the senior military officers, only they knew that there was this Holt memorandum written to the Ministry of Defence. So when that, there'd been lots of rumours within days, but he was the first person to say, yes, I was there, this is my name, you can use it. And basically, that in a Freedom of Information request trawl, unexpectedly, it was very unexpected, and I talked with Holt over this, when he realised that this memorandum was going to go public, he tried to get it pulled. He did not want it to go out because he knew it would change his life forever, and it certainly did. So when that unexpected troll-produced document, then you had this document that then said that there was at least 2 nights of activity. We now know, over the many years of research that's been done, a lot of great research being done over the years, that there's at least 3 nights that are consecutive, but possibly 4 nights consecutive. We talk about, as you just said, that people associate the Rendlesham Forest incident, or as the Americans always call it, the Bentwaters incident, but now more recognised as Rendlesham over the years, that it's heavily associated with Holt, Penistone and Burroughs. Now, let me tell you, they have all done and had great sighting. Nobody's taking that away from them. But here's a thing from an investigative point of view, wearing my police detective hat. Rarely, in a top 10 UFO case in the world, do you have witnesses that then become the investigators over and above civilian researchers. And unfortunately, I don't think that is healthy for the case, and I know all the participants, I've met them all, but it's not healthy because each one of them, to a degree, has a bias. And realistically, I can't think, if you think of the Roswell case, did the Roswell witnesses become the investigators? No, they didn't. You have people like Don Smith, Stanton Friedman, Tom Carey, they're doing the research and making a fantastic case. It is a fantastic case, but I have talked to witnesses who do not want to go public, who were there at Rendlesham, who will say to me, I don't want to get involved in this, the way the case is being portrayed now by Holt, Penistone and Burroughs. There are people deliberately not getting involved who could get involved, and we need their testimony, but they don't like the way the case is presented.
You said that Larry Warren, and this will be revealed in Capel Green, that he passed his account.
He passed the lie detector, but this will be shown on camera.
So just spend a few minutes telling us what Larry Warren saw.
Yes. The Capel Green. The Capel Green is the field where Larry Warren has always claimed that he went into the field with a sergeant, Adrian Bistinza. He was picked up from a perimeter post, 18, one-person post, got in a truck. He then went to the motor pool. They were told to collect light holes and take them out into the forest. He was thinking this is an exercise. He did not. He'd only been on the base three, 4 weeks at that time. He's still thinking this is an exercise, what's going on. Anyway, they get to a staging area. They can't go into the forest any further because there isn't the road to get any closer, so they have to walk on foot. They're split up into small teams. He then sees, as he's approaching, what he can see is a lit up field through the trees. And as he gets to the edge of the field, he sees for the first time what he says is a circular patch of ground-hugging yellow mist that's really strange. It's maybe only 30 centimetres off the ground, and it's about 50 foot in a circular size. And he sees lots of other security police officers around. He sees two British police officers stood back on his right. He sees that there is somebody filming on a tripod, which is kind of bizarre, as if it infers that somebody knew that something was coming. Then he is told to go further into the field, and where this mist was, suddenly a red light comes in from the coast about the size of a basketball, and then it stops over the mist. Then there's an explosion of light, and where the mist had been, there was then a like translucent, shimmering craft, a machine of type that you couldn't look directly at. You had to look through your peripheral, and it was kind of like delta shape, triangular delta shape, with a red light on the top and a blue light at the bottom, and it was there where the mist had been. And now the crazy thing is, and it does sound like science fiction, is that a short time later, senior officers, which is believed to be Colonel Williams, that's not nailed on. It's believed by Larry Warren that it's Colonel Williams, but a group of senior officers arrive. They walk into the field. One of them, believed to be Colonel Williams, who retired as a two-star general, walks up too close to this object, and where there are three floating entities. Sounds like science fiction. but it's not science fiction. And when I was tasked to get involved in this and I accepted the responsibility, I went back to day one from the first, well, as soon as the incident occurred, to the first things that were reported in the press and followed the story all the way through. And what I find is there are many independent confirmations that the incident in the field with the craft and entities was widely recorded. So this is not just Larry Warren's account. So Purple Green is about two-thirds the human interest story, because Larry Warren has been vilified literally from day one, from going public in 83, because he told this controversial story, even though he is the original military whistleblower. Even though he has had so much abuse, he stuck to the story. And there's, you know, as somebody who was a detective and an advanced interviewer of suspects and witnesses, I'd met him many times, and I'd heard him, I'd talked to him. I'd always believed his account was genuine, because he simply knew too much information. Now, the campaign to discredit him, which is only very small, perhaps 50 people led by four or five, but very, very vociferous and abusive, they will try to say that he borrowed Adrian Bustinza's story. Well, all of that will be discussed in the film, and believe me, there are many, many confirmations to say that the incident happened. And let's not forget that one of the witnesses who's never been on camera that's appearing in Purple Green is a guy called Steve Longero. He went through training, police training, with Larry Warren, knew him because they're on the same course. They arrived at the base on the same day, or within a day of each other. They arrive together, they go through this base training together. They then go on to shift separately, but they're allocated on to shift. And what this documentary is going to reveal is that he will say that Larry Warren was in that field, end off. Not in the field, in the staging area. He sees him there, being briefed when a lot of people are being briefed and put into four-man teams. There is lots of confirmation, which I'm not going to reveal for the sake of this, but that's for the film, and the director kill me if I reveal too much.
We can see trailers.
New and old information, especially old information, a lot of good stuff that's never been shown to the public, which will cast a different light on this case and hopefully open it up that others will come forward.
When we come back, you'll tell us where we can see the trailers on YouTube. We'll also open up the phone lines. Questions and comments for Gary Heseltine. If you want to talk about Rendlesham, if you want to talk about his police reporting UFO sightings database, we can do that as well. And if you like what you're hearing tonight this morning, you might want to check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show, which airs live Sunday nights, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern, and in delay on about 40 affiliates across North America. For more information and a list of affiliates, you can visit strangeplanet.ca. That's my website, strangeplanet.ca. And while you're at it, why not check out my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. To listen and subscribe, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Why has Rendlesham Forest whistleblower Larry Warren become akin to kissing the third rail in the ufology arena? Gary Heseltine will discuss on the other side, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Gary, I understand why initially, you know, going back 36 years ago in 83, why Colonel Charles Hult would be angry that Larry Warren inadvertently sort of outed him when he came forward as the original whistleblower on Rendlesham. But again, that's 36 years ago. If anyone who has suffered, it's Larry Warren. You know, all of the other principals involved in this, you know, you see them at the UFO conferences. Larry Warren doesn't get invited, as far as I know, to these UFO conferences. I don't understand what is so upsetting about Larry Warren.
You've hit the nail on the head, and to succinctly put it together, let's look at this premise. If Larry Warren was telling the truth about his involvement in witnessing a landed UFO, three entities, and a meeting between a nuclear base commander and three entities, do you think the American government, the American military, the British government, the British military would want that event to be confirmed?
So it's the fact that he has confirmed that there were nukes on that base? Is that it?
No, several people have confirmed that there were nukes on the burst.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah, so that's not the issue. The issue is if that event is indeed real, which I will prove through the documentary that it almost certainly is, then that is a huge threat to the Americans and the British. It was a nuclear base. However, they had more nuclear weapons in the Bentwater storage area than anywhere else in Europe. And Colonel Holt told me that on two occasions. The first time on my own, when I first met him, and the second occasion with my wife, who will corroborate me, and she has a trigger moment for remembering why he did that. All right, and she can tell her own story in Capel Green. The point is, if that event is real, can you imagine a frontline strike base, 14,000 personnel, nuclear strike, tactical nuclear weapons at the base in Bentwaters, and suddenly there is a base commander or a senior military officer meeting face-to-face, silently, in a face-off from 10, 15 feet with three floating entities next to what, to all of, you know, how else can you describe it, some kind of craft. That is a major game changer if that event is real. And he inadvertently told that story, which did not tell the story of Holt, Peniston and Burroughs. And yet Larry's story was out there first. And there, like I said earlier, there are many, many confirmations from independent sources that say that that event occurred that had nothing to do with Larry White, which will be discussed in the film. So I am absolutely certain with my detective head on that event occurred, but that event is a threat. They shouldn't have had those nuclear weapons there in those numbers, and it broke the defense armament agreements between Britain and the United States. Do you not think that might cause some embarrassment if this event was true? But can you imagine a nuclear base commander meeting with three entities in a field? If that were true, that is dynamite. So the one person that says it, a 19-year-old, fresh out of training, sticks his head up, and all these years, don't you think that if he'd borrowed the story, that if he'd made it all up, that he would have got sick and tired of the abuse he's had for 37 years, 36 years now, since it all went public? It's ridiculous. You wouldn't put yourself through that if it weren't true. And he's now passed a lie detector on those events that said what he's saying is true and passes with flying colours. That is a dangerous scenario, and there's always been the real motive as to why Larry Warren was given a hard time and still is.
Let's go to the first-time caller. Benjamin is in Carson City, Nevada. Benjamin, welcome to Coast AM. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for having my call today. How are you
My
doing?
Pleasure. Well, thank you.
So I was just calling because I've had an experience, and I thought maybe this is the right place to talk about it.
All right. Well, let's hear it, Benjamin.
Me and my brother, we live in an area where there's a lot of desert, and we like to take the quad out into the hills and, like, go quadding and have fun. So sometimes we'll go out there and we'll do stuff like we'll go out on a full moon and we'll go way out into the desert and just sit in the nature and let nature resume and let the animals, like, you know, resume what they're doing around us and just, like, meditate and stuff and try to, like, become, you know, peaceful with the environment around us. And so we're out on a full moon and we're on our way back. It's probably, like, 4 in the morning. And the moon was so bright. it was lighting up the landscape enough for us to have the headlight on the quad off. So we're driving down the dirt road, and we're probably about 2 miles away from the main road to get to our house. And as we're going, this black triangle, like maybe 3 feet long, maybe 2 feet wide, and very thin, maybe 5 inches, you know, tall, black triangle swooped down and kind of did like a left to right swinging motion for a very brief period, and then fixated, just stopped and matched our speed. So we're probably doing about 15 miles an hour on the quad, just cruising, and it just matched our speed about 5 feet in front of us for maybe 2 or 3 seconds. And I lifted my hand up and I got the word out of my mouth, and my brother was looking up at it too. And as soon as I acknowledged it and pointed at it, it went straight up into the sky, like at a rapid speed, like unlike anything I've ever seen. Like, and it was absolutely silent. It was not flapping like an animal. It wasn't moving like a biological, you know, creature, like an owl or a bat or something. It was still, and it fixated in front of us and matched our speed completely silently, and then just took off straight up into the sky. And me and my brother, we have exactly the same recollection of this. And my brother's much older than me. He's in his 40s, and, you know, we're both pretty serious people. You know, like, I wouldn't try to make anything up like this. It's an amazing experience. I'm not really sure how to explain, you know, what exactly happened.
No, you did a fine job detailing that, Benjamin. What strikes me about that story is most of the time when we hear about these triangular craft, they are enormous. But this one, just a little teeny tiny thing. Gary, did you want to comment before we move on the next call?
I would thank him for coming forward. And if he's not told that story before because he's based in the States, I'd say report it to Peter Davenport or to Newfound and check it out. I mean, to be honest, I have several cases on the police database where in one particular case, there is an officer, two officers, described seeing a black triangular object just above treetop level, the size of 3 football fields. And it was such a gigantic size. I said, how do you know it was so big? And he said, because when we saw it, it was above 3 football fields. So that's a pretty good description of size. No noise. But it's very unusual to hear of a very small black triangle. So I would suggest that you report that.
Absolutely, yes. Peter Davenport, the National UFO Reporting Center. West of the Rockies, Lisa is in Seattle. Good morning, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I was in Seattle where the Boeing plant is, and it's like in Renton, really, but it's on the lake. And I saw this craft, but it looked like a space rocket or spaceship. It didn't look like a plane or a UFO. It was like a cylinder, and it looked just like a rocket ship. It was very silver, and it was huge. It had to be, I don't know, because I'm looking like maybe 2 miles away. And this thing was hovering in the air, and it was pointed toward that Boeing plant. And I'm like, you know, and when I looked, because I was driving along the lake, I saw a big, giant flash of light, like a glare. And it was the sun, because it was setting, and it was shining off of this object. That's what drew my attention. So when I looked, and it's sitting there still, and, you know, I'm driving, so I had to look away. And when I looked back, that thing was gone. And I don't know anything that could go that fast, and it could hover like that and be that big, but it was so shiny. And I've never seen anything that looked like a rocket ship, but it flew like a plane.
All right, Lisa, thank you for that. Gary, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, an excellent sighting. Did she report it? Did you report it, Lisa?
Pardon?
Did you report it?
Report it to anyone?
No, I didn't report it because, like, I didn't know where it was, and I told several friends about it, and just the fact that it was sitting there hovering over a major Boeing plant, kind of, you know, but it was like, you know, miles away, but it was that big to where I could see it. But when I looked back, that thing had disappeared, and I wouldn't have ever seen it if the sun hadn't glinted off of it, and it was such a flash of light, you know, when that sun hit it. And I was, like, totally amazed. But I looked on the Internet. There are some people that report they have seen something that looked like a rocket ship, like a cylinder or, you know.
I have cases on the police database of police officers. One, I can think of two cases straight away where officers describe a cylindrical object, no wings, no tail.
Yeah, no wing, no tail.
Silently, about 200 feet long.
It was huge because Mercer Island is an island that's about 3 miles long. And I'm telling you, it was big enough. It was on the south end of Mercer Island. It was huge enough to where it looked like the biggest plane you ever saw. We got a lot of planes out here.
My, oh, my. Well, Lisa, thank you for sharing that. That's a remarkable story. Let me circle back to Rendlesham for a moment, if I could, Gary. And not having seen the documentary, of course, but, I mean, are there other Larry Warrens out there that we're not aware of, that maybe you are aware of, that will be coming forward to corroborate Larry's story?
Well, this will all be discussed in the film. There are lots of confirmations of the Larry Warren account, historically, and new information. However, what I would say is that the account would say that in that field, there are anywhere from 20 to 40 security police, perhaps civilians as well, perhaps civilian or different police, different military departments out there in the periphery. We know that overall it's estimated anywhere between 100 and 200 people on the bases, the twin bases, Bentwaters and Woodbridge, saw over that period some elements, whether it be lights in the sky, lights in the forest, to closer events. I tell you what, the documentary will also feature that's never been shown before. It's going to bring forward three new witnesses that are going to show three what's called precursor cases that led up to the events in late December. So there's going to be a case and a reenactment for February 1980, June 1980, and then October 1980. These have never gone on camera before and certainly never been involved in reenactments. And it's going to show you that this was not lighthouses, which has always been ridiculous, but still TV will mention it in every documentary. This was always, in my opinion, a UFO-related event. What it is, we don't know, but certainly a craft, entities were there, whatever you want to describe them. Something there that was physical, that was intelligent, was on that base. And these three precursor cases all nicely lead up to the events that are taking place. But one other quick thing is, let's not forget why perhaps ET, which I think it was an ET event, was interested in those bases, the nuclear weapons, the amount of nuclear weapons. And don't forget, in the context of history, at the time this was happening in late December, there were thousands, hundreds of thousands of Soviet troops massing on the Polish borders, ready and looked like to invade Poland because of the Lech Wałęsa Polish shipyard workers rising up against the Soviet Union. And also the American hostage crisis was still going on, the 52 American hostages. So we have two world events, and I think that UFOs have got a long history. We've been interested in nuclear weapons, power plants, etc. Robert Hastings' book, UFOs and Nukes, is a brilliant book that outlines that, the documentary outlines that clear correlation between UFOs and an interest in nuclear weapons, facilities, etc. That's what it's all about, and that's why it's so sensitive. And really, that's why Larry Warren's always had such a hard time.
Very quickly, on the wild card line, Rick is in Phoenix, Arizona. Quick question, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. In the iconic movies like Close Encounters, there was a scene very similar to an account Mr. Hazelton mentioned, that a football-long vehicle that I believe the two officers watched. It was about 500 feet high. And it's very reminiscent of the scene in Close Encounters that toward the end where the mothership has smaller lights around it. And I wondered if there were any other cinematic scenes that he thought were particularly representative of this situation, and maybe Independence Day or what they're doing with us. Maybe they're preparing us for their appearance and trying to prevent a nuclear war.
Gary, we've got about a minute.
Quick one on that. Like I've just said, there's a big historical connection between UFOs and nuclear weapons. I think that's what Rendlesham is really all about. It's an incredible event. The documentary will not just feature on the Capel Green. It will tell the whole story of all the nights, all the story and the background, and reveal more facts than ever before. Anybody who wants to get a free copy of UFO Truth magazine, if you email me at heseltinegary@hotmail.com, and I'm sure you'll put the link out, anybody can request a complimentary copy from any one of the 34 issues out to date.
And again, the email is
heseltinegary@hotmail.com. Just my name in reverse at hotmail.com.
And where quickly can we see the trailers for Capel Green?
I think I've given you a link to the program, but it's Capel Green, written as one word, .co.uk. We've already had something like a quarter of a million views so far. There's four trailers to view, each one of different lengths, revealing different things. My pledge to the public is I will reveal more information than ever before about Rendlesham Forest, and surely that's a good thing.
Gary, thank you so much for hanging out for the last 2 hours. I've enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure, and what I would suggest is if anybody wants to do a follow-up show where we just focus on 2 hours talking about the RFI, the Rendlesham Forest Incident, I'd be more than happy to do it.
It's a deal. All right. Thank you again. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galanti, Chris Burrows, Mike Cozio, Gina Salvati, Sean Latasor, and here in Toronto, Mike Bendixson, Robert Turner, and Patrick O'Neill, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time.